Apex Express, Asian Pacific Expression.
Community and cultural coverage.
Music and calendar.
New visions and voices.
Coming to you with an Asian Pacific Islander point of view.
It's time to get on board the Apex Express.
You are tuned into Apex Express on KPFA, bringing you an Asian and Pacific Islander view from the Bay and around the world. I'm Tara Darabji, kicking it with you tonight, and today is August 15th. August 15th, 1947 marked India's independence from Britain. Tonight, we'll be looking at the shadow of independence. The partition of India and Pakistan created the largest land migration in human history. An estimated 1 million people died from the rioting and fighting. We'll be hearing the story of a partition survivor, and then we'll turn to Kashmir. While India and Pakistan celebrate independence, Kashmiris shine the light on occupation. First off, though, we landed in Japan, where the intensifying nuclear crisis at Fukushima continues. We also have some ticket giveaways for you all out there. We're going to be giving away some tickets to Zap Mama tonight in Oakland. And then we have another pair of tickets to the September 1st anniversary show of Dub Mission in San Francisco. We have all this and more after Apex's global news headlines. Keep it locked.
This is Marie Che with this week's Apex Update. As the international debate on government surveillance continues, tens of thousands took to the streets in cities around South Korea to protest the National Intelligence Service's interference in the country's last presidential election. Evidence is emerging that the NIS ran an online campaign to influence public opinion. Protesters believe that the NIS enlisted large numbers of civilians to write online posts accusing opponents of President Park Geun-hye and the Saenuri Party of being communist instigators and North Korean sympathizers. The former NIS chief was indicted on allegations that he personally orchestrated the operation, and the former Seoul police chief is being prosecuted for covering it up. Protests against the NIS began in June, organized by university students. They have since attracted large crowds and the backing of the opposition Minjudang Party. They are calling for an apology from conservative President Park Geun-hye, the removal of the NIS director, and complete NIS reform. President Park and the Saenuri Party have not been cooperating with the National Assembly's legislative probe into the matter. After 4 months of talks, North and South Korea have reached an agreement to reopen the Kaesong Industrial Complex, a joint economic zone between North and South Korea. The complex was closed in April after the United States flew stealth bombers capable of dropping nuclear weapons over the Korean Peninsula. In response, the DPRK pulled its 53,000-person workforce out of the Kaesong factories. In this round of talks, the South backed off its demand that North Korea take full responsibility for the shutdown. Both sides agreed that they would not shut down the complex in the future, and North Korea agreed to protect the safety of South Korean employees and equipment. They also agreed to open the complex to foreign companies. The two sides are creating a joint committee to facilitate logistics around the economic zone, including how to address damages caused by the shutdown. The agreement comes less than 1 week before South Korea and the U.S. are scheduled to hold their annual joint military exercises, where they simulate invading the DPRK. A date for reopening the Kaesong complex has not yet been set. Just weeks after the country's disputed elections, Cambodia is putting off accepting military aid from the United States and several other countries until its new government is formed. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harp made this announcement.
Following the elections, the Cambodian Ministry of Defense postponed or canceled a number of international military programs, including with the United States.
The country's July 28th elections were fraught with allegations of voter disenfranchisement, including claims that the ruling Cambodian People's Party removed over 1 million names from the voter rolls and changed vote tallies. Here's a spokesperson from the opposition Cambodian National Rescue Party.
We express great disappointment and have decided to reject the temporary results of the election announced by the National Election Committee.
Prime Minister Hun Sen has deployed additional troops throughout the capital to discourage mass protests. On Monday, an activist with the Cambodian National Rescue Party was gunned down when two gunmen knocked on his door and shot him in the head. Some U.S. lawmakers have threatened to cut U.S. military aid to Cambodia if the recent elections are found to be fraudulent. The U.S. has been training Cambodian military officers since 2006. The country's National Election Committee initially planned to form a bipartisan group to investigate poll irregularities, but has scrapped that plan and reaffirmed Hun Sen's victory. Today, the Gorkha Janmukti Morcha, or the GJM, announced that they are taking a break from their 12-day strike for a separate state of Gorkhaland in western Bengal. The strike paralyzed the region economically as people blocked traffic and closed shops and restaurants. The region's large Darjeeling tea industry was exempt from the strike, but took a major hit as storage and transportation facilities were not operating. Gorkhas have been demanding an autonomous state since the 1980s. In 1988, Gorkha leaders accepted limited autonomy over the region. And in 2011, the Gorkhaland Territorial Administration was established to govern the area. Here's GJM Secretary Roshan Giri.
Clearly stated that it is not the division of Bengal. These territories were never the part of Bengal, Darjeeling and Doors. If you go back to history, we are very different from the rest of West Bengal. Our culture, our language, our tradition, it is very different. So why can't we be given a separate statehood?
Over 300 GJM supporters have been arrested since this round of protests began, and central forces were deployed to Darjeeling to stop the protests. Here's GJM supporter Pratibha Taman.
As you know, state government, West Bengal government, Ms. Mamata Banerjee, is trying to suppress our demand by using the force. Not only police, but CRPF. But we condemn her decision and we protest her. We are not afraid of CRP, lathi, gun, etc., etc. We are on the ground, and you people know and seeing you people, our demand is, our movement is democratic. If the time constitution government wants violence, they can violence. But we are, our demand and our movement will on and on in non-violence. But if they want bloodshed, then we are ready to die. Yes. But we are not going to non-violence.
The GJM has announced a three-day break to provide relief from the strike so that food and fuel can be brought in. On Friday, the GJM will decide whether to resume the strike. A federal court judge ruled this week that the New York Police Department's practice of stop and frisk is a violation of civil rights and should be overseen by an independent monitor. The judge found that New York City police officers disproportionately stop and frisk people of color. 80% of those stopped are either Black or Latino, and 90% are not charged with any crimes. A new video by the New York-based Communities United for Police Reform shows the impact of the NYPD's stop and frisk policies.
I think people shouldn't have to live in fear. The point of police is not to instill fear, but I think the point of police is to protect people, to have them not feel like fear. My name is Kasim Walters. I'm a senior in high school, and I'm from Flatbush, Brooklyn. The first time I was stopped and frisked, I was about 13 years old. I was, of course, leaving my house on my way to school to pick up a friend. My friend lives about maybe a block and a half away from me. And I was walking up the block. I made the left on New York Avenue. I was just waiting outside. And then the cops just pulled up and they were like, oh, what are you doing? I was like, I'm waiting for my friend. And they was like, he lives here. And I was like, yeah. They went through my book bag, through my stuff on the ground and all that. They were just asking me questions, being rough with me, telling me where I'm going to end up. You want to end up in jail? And then they both became very aggressive, searching in my pockets, turning me around and pushing me, like forcing my legs open, like yanking me. So at that moment, I don't know, I mean, frightened, definitely frightened. Frightened and confused. The thing that changed for me first is the way I looked at police. I couldn't look at them the same. I remember, I mean, it was bad to a point where I got robbed. I didn't call the police. They scare you now, so they instill this fear in you, and then it forces you to have this mindset that you are a criminal. So you wake up now and you're like, am I gonna get stopped? Maybe I should wear something so I don't get stopped. Maybe I shouldn't wear a hoodie. If I see cops, it's like, should I cross the street? I don't want them to think I'm suspicious. Should I stay on the street and get harassed by them? And that's something that you shouldn't have to be paranoid about. I shouldn't have to be afraid of my commute. I think the police's job is to get to know us, to make us feel like we can go to them, to make us feel like when we see them, we don't have to walk across the street. When we see them, we can say, what's up, without them thinking we mean it sarcastically. When you look around, you should feel safer when you see a cop. You shouldn't feel like you're a target. And I think that's the main goal, is that we should feel like citizens of New York and not criminals.
An independent monitor will be reviewing the NYPD's practices and making recommendations. The judge also ordered NYPD officers to wear cameras on their bodies.
Tuned into Apex Express on KPFA. I'm Tara Darabji. That's the Her Story of Soul by Naima Shalhoub, Oakland's own. And she's performing tonight, opening up for Zap Mama. And that's going to be at the New Parish in Oakland. And we have two pairs of tickets to give away. I want to get you out, up, out of the house, moving. This show starts at 8:30, so that's, you know, an hour away. It's 18th Street and San Pablo in Oakland. I'm going to take callers number 2 and callers number 4, 510-848-4425. Change your night, you know, get out. You can bring a friend, see who's going to come with you. It'll be fun. So two pairs of tickets, callers number 2 and 4, that's 510-848-4425 for Zap Mama. Naima Shalhoub is opening and DJs Ladies and DJ Julico. All right, and we also have with us tonight, live from Japan on the line, Eileen Miyoko Smith. She's the executive director of Green Action Japan, and she's going to discuss the ongoing nuclear crisis in Fukushima. Over 2 years ago, March 2011, a tsunami hit Japan, causing the Fukushima nuclear reactors to eventually melt down. And now, 2 years later, the Japanese government is stepping in to help manage the nuclear disaster, just recently declaring it a serious emergency that TEPCO, the company managing the reactors, and is unable to handle. The Fukushima plant is still leaking about 300 tons of radioactive water into the ocean every day, 300 tons, according to Japanese officials. We are joined by Eileen Miyoko-Smith. She's the executive director of Green Action Japan. Eileen Miyoko-Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day. And tell us about the latest developments with the nuclear disaster in Fukushima.
Well, we have a great deal of concern that there are radioactive discharges from the Fukushima Daiichi accident site into the ocean. We know that the earthquake damaged the ground underneath the plant, and there's tons of wires and pipes and conduits underground. And we know that there's a lot of groundwater coming down from the surrounding area. It's always had been coming down before the Fukushima accident. About two Olympic pools worth of water always needing to be pumped out from before the accident. But that whole pumping system didn't function anymore after the accident. So we're very concerned about the underground water, and we don't have answers to it, and I want to address that more. But that's happening, and at the same time, in Fukushima, what they've been doing is earlier this month, rezoned the evacuation areas where they're trying to get people back in. There's been a lot of effort to decontaminate it, the ground, the environment in Fukushima. It's not been working or working well at all. But the government is trying to get quote-unquote status quo as much as possible and getting people back into some areas. And this is without any kind of public discussion with the citizens involved. And also the government is cutting off the deadline for seeking compensation for economic loss. For example, if you don't have access to your house anymore, you can't go back or whatever. And so people are kind of between a rock and a hard place because a lot of people don't want to go back, but their area is being declared as okay to go back. There are other people who want to go back, but they can't go back, and they're in limbo still, tens of thousands of people, thousands of people waiting outside, not knowing what their future is.
And, where are these tens of thousands of people waiting?
They're waiting in evacuation areas outside, and it's called temporary housing, but it's getting to be kind of permanent for them. And even the citizens that are allowed back into their area and they go to their house, it's like nature's taken over. The mice have taken over. The whole place is almost impossible to live in. And, of course, the radiation levels are still of deep concern to individuals. And what's really just so sad is that, you realize in society, in a community, the reason the community is alive is because you have everybody there. You have children, you have families wanting to raise children, you have older people, you have everybody there. And if only certain people can go back young children, family, people don't want to have families there, raise their children there. The elementary schools used to have like 1,000 children, and now they have 40. You cannot have a viable community anymore. And so there are dilemmas all over in all the towns in Fukushima and then the contaminated areas, which is the eastern half, with various stories. Each town is different. Each family is different.
And Eileen Miyoko-Smith, getting back to sort of the latest escalation with the crisis with the water that they have on site that is starting to leak out of the facility and they don't know what to do with on top of the 300 tons of radioactive water that's released into the ocean every day. So now the Japanese government is sort of stepping in to try to contain it. Is there any hope of containing this? And sort of what's the prognosis of the situation?
Well, it's hard to know how to contain it when they don't really know where the source is, the sources are. I think it's really important to realize that the Fukushima accident is literally ongoing. I mean, it's sort of like a continual kind of accident. And remember with Chernobyl, how it was really horrible and terrible and really difficult to do, and a lot of people and workers received radiation doses. But they covered with a sarcophagus, sort of sealed off Chernobyl on the top. Well, the problem is you don't see it, but with Fukushima underground, because of the earthquake, this huge, massive underground conduits, pipes, wires, trenches, it's received earthquake damage, you know, and we don't know where and how much. Even the foundation, they say it hasn't been damaged that much, the reactor building, but they don't say it has not been damaged. That's TEPCO and the government. And so all that's going on. At the same time, Japan has a lot of water, and every day in Fukushima, even from before the accident, about two Olympic pools worth of water came onto the site underground and was being pumped by just dozens and dozens of wells out, and that system isn't working anymore. So all that groundwater is underneath, and so people have been saying it's a matter of time before it really starts going all over the place to the really contaminated areas underground. And there's been an attempt to seal it off, and the first wall, the four walls underground, what they did is they put it against the ocean. And so what happened is all this groundwater is building, and so it sort of like acted as a dam, and it started overflowing into that area right in the vicinity of the ocean, which was unluckily the most contaminated area where the trenches, a month after the accident, there was a big release, and it's really contaminated. So the water got even more contaminated and then overflowed. So, you know, the levels in the ocean have not been going down. And right now, for example, you know, with the tritium, it's like the amount that's allowed when nuclear power plants operate. I mean, nuclear power plants are leaking radiation all the time, you know. But there's serious high levels of like cesium and strontium going in. But the quantity, what is of concern is that the levels are going up. And it's... also, the contamination under the ground seems to be spreading, and that we don't know the source. And so it's sort of like it's like a time bomb where we don't really know what's happening. And there's been a budget. The government finally came in, but the budget is for next fiscal year. And it just, things are really moving slowly. We met with the government, and the big problem is that the government has been, like the Nuclear Regulation Authority, they spend most of the time on working on restart of nuclear power in Japan. I mean, like the amount of work they put into that versus dealing with Fukushima, especially like these discharges. The discharge is minimal compared to, for example, with the restart. There were two reactors that had to be reviewed, OE Unit 3 and 4, the only two that are operating in Japan right now. They spent so much time on that. You know, 14 public hearings, 19 closed closed door meetings, compared to the discharge, which is just a handful of public meetings, several. And the meetings that they do have closed door is like the minimal minutes come out, but it's like a bidding. You know, big construction companies are bidding. It's mainly like a bidding meeting and presentation by big construction meetings companies. So there's really no transparency on these. The issue of the groundwater, and that's what we're demanding: more transparency of the meetings and more rapid, you know, dealing with this whole problem.
Eileen Miyoko Smith, thank you so much for joining us on KPFA and giving us an update on this ongoing, unfolding, horrendous disaster in Fukushima. If people want to stay up to date on what's happening and be able to really follow and get more information as you demand transparency from the Japanese government and make that information available to the public, what's your website?
Okay, our website is just type in Green Action Japan and you'll come to it. And we have an English site. And there's a petition going on called We All Share Oceans. So if you're concerned about the discharges, you can sign on, sign the petition. And also, if the international community could say, we got to get international experts coming here. If you could, you know, call the Japanese consulate, Japanese embassy, or the U.S. NRC saying, look, you know, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric, can't deal with this anymore. The Japanese government is really behind dealing on it. You know, there needs to be some international concerted action.
Eileen Miyoko-Smith calling for international support and action in Japan for the Fukushima nuclear disaster and for people to sign the petition that we all share oceans. Thank you so much, Eileen Miyoko-Smith, for joining us on Apex Express.
Thank you so much. And you can go to the FOE Japan site, too, and the petition is there.
Great. And we'll be right back. We're going to go to a short music break and come back at you.
Big, bad, we must have been large. Big, bad, we must have been large. Yoosh! All right, so now it's all about the songs of DJ Seth alongside Chapman. And the tune coming like a big wrong bang. Bomb murder, you know me big, me bad, me massive and me large. And with me hold the mic, me comfy rum up session. You know me big, me bad, me massive and me large. And when me come a place, you know them bomb murder. Well, pick up your soul, DJ Sep every time. And the big bad ragamuffin Chapman, I say that.
You're tuned into Apex Express. I'm Tara Darabji, and those are the sounds of DJ Sep mixing it up for us. Sunday, September 1st, is Dub Mission's 17th anniversary, and I have a pair of tickets to give away to that show. It's going to be featuring Dub Mission's DJ Sep, Manish, The Twister, Vinny, Esparza, and Ludacris on the turntables. It's going to be the release party for Biggering Rhythm EP produced by DJ Seps with vocals by Dr. Israel and Mr. Chapman. That's at the Elbow Room in the Mission, 21 and up. I'm going to give away tickets September 1st. That's my birthday. Maybe I'm going to cruise through. Not sure, but maybe. Sunday, one pair of tickets. The next day is Labor Day, so it's a great day to go out. Get your reggae on 510-848-4425. We're going to take caller number 6 for the pair of tickets to the 17th anniversary of Dub Mission, keeping some reggae for us all in Valencia, in La Misión. And gonna switch gears a little bit with that. Today is August 15th. It's India's Independence Day, and yesterday was Pakistan, and all over people are celebrating independence in the subcontinent. And while the nonviolent struggle of Gandhi is often revered and the story of India's independence retold, the British partitioning of India rests in the shadows. The 1947 partitioning of India marks the landest land migration in human history. About 10 million people were forced to migrate. An estimated 1 million people died from rioting and fighting. Today we'll hear from the Partition Archive and listen to a survivor of partition. And then we'll be looking also at protests in Kashmir as India and Pakistan celebrate independence. Kashmir shines the light on occupation. We have with us in studio Gunita Singhbala. She's the executive director of the Berkeley-based 1947 Partition Archive. Welcome to KPFA.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, and Gunita Singhbala, tell me how you came to start recording the voices of survivors of the partition.
Well, it's something that I had thought about for many, many years since I was a teenager. I had learned about the Holocaust in high school extensively, and I'd learned about the partition at home from my grandparents, but the partition was not taught in school. And that bothered me as a kid, and as I was growing up, that was always in the back of my mind. And then in 2008, I was in Hiroshima, where I visited the Peace Memorial, and I heard the oral testimonies there. Actually, I watched the interviews, and that's sort of when it clicked that we need to do this for partition because it was very powerful.
And how has the story of partition and the experience of the partition of the subcontinent affected your family?
So my paternal grandparents migrated from Lahore, which is now in Pakistan, to Delhi, which is in India.
And so you grew up with that story. Was it something that was talked about, or was it something that was known but not spoken of?
It was talked about, not frequently, but sometimes.
And you founded the Partition Archive and have gone out and started recording these interviews and put together a whole volunteer team. How many interviews have you recorded with Partition survivors?
So we have about 650 stories, 1 to 7 hours long, and they're on HD video.
7 hours from a single survivor?
Yeah. They're life stories shaped by partition, so it encompasses the entire life story.
And how many interviews have you done?
I've been involved in about 100 of them. That means that in some cases I was the camera person.
And in doing all of these, what is your hope?
I guess that's several fold. So I think for one, you know, why do you record history? It's so that we can learn from it and move on and, you know, make better decisions in the future. Secondly, I think there's a cathartic element to this. A lot of people have wanted to share their story and there hasn't been a platform. And even though we've lost a lot of the people, there's still time. There are still people who, you know, can take advantage of that. And lastly, I think there's an intergenerational element that I'm very excited about. Like when I first started recording stories, I found it to be a very powerful experience to listen to elders and record their stories. And so when I watch other people have that similar interaction, because anyone can come and become what we call a citizen historian with us, I think it's really neat. And I think both people, the interviewer and interviewee, come away, you know, changed people.
And when you're looking at the modern day interactions between India and Pakistan, you're talking about a highly militarized line of control, two nuclear weapons, armed states with nuclear weapons pointed at each other, gunfire erupting from the border. How do you see recording of these stories and keeping that part of the story of the subcontinent alive as building the understanding of people between those two countries?
Well, I guess, you know, we stay completely out of the politics. So we're mostly concerned with stories of humans, and everybody's human on either side of the border. And the stories are pretty much identical. And I think, yeah.
So showing the human behind.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's really neat when people on either sides of the border, especially the younger people who are completely unfamiliar with, you know, what's going on the other side of the border, they grew up in a time, unlike their elders who lived in a time before there was a border there. They're usually quite intrigued to see, oh, that's kind of very similar to what we see over here, except, you know, those stories are kind of mirror images of each other.
And you have the stories archived on your website. What's your website?
It's 1947partitionarchive.org.
1947partitionarchive.org. And I know that you picked out an interview for us of one that you were part of. Can you tell us a little bit about the story we're about to listen to?
Yeah, so the story you're about to listen to is of a gentleman named Ali Shan. He's based in the Bay Area, and he had contacted us about sharing his story, which he had not yet shared with his family at the time, or really anybody. And it was a very moving story. He was actually orphaned during partition. He migrated from East Punjab to West Punjab. I take that back. So he migrated from Ludhiana district to Kasur, which is in Pakistani Punjab, and Ludhiana is in Indian Punjab. And I thought it was an incredible experience for me to be hearing the story that he had not really shared yet. And I think it was a very tough experience for him to share it.
All right, let's go to that story right now.
One morning we were sleeping and there was a loud voices. So there I saw thousands of people surrounding the village with arms. Then my uncle came running. So he took us to the center of the village. He said to go into that room and stay there. And all the village women and children were in that room. After about maybe 2-3 hours, which was like an eternity for us, somebody banged on the door and the guy shouted that, open the door, otherwise we will fire inside and set the room in fire. So they told us to sit under a big tree and they start killing. My cousin got shot, and then my brother, he saw what was going on, so he started running. So one guy came with a spear and hit him. So my mother saw that and she ran after him. So she fell over him and they both were killed there. I was very traumatized. I was standing there not knowing what's happening. The gunman was only about 10 feet away, sort of. You know, he shot at me a few times every time he missed. So I started running there. One guy came with a spear. He tried to kill me. In the meantime, I bumped into the other guy. He was killing too. The other guy came to kill. He said, no, don't kill him. And the guy said, why not? And the one who was holding me, he said, no, I want to take this child with me. We were traveling, and I was always wondering what's going to happen to me. And where he's taking me, he didn't explain to me anything. We walked 2 nights, day and night, to get to some village, which I don't know the name now. So there, he left me with the family. And then 6 months, I lived with them. Because there was agreement with India and Pakistan that whoever was left in both countries, they should be recovered and brought back to the respective countries. They came and I had about 9:30, 10 o'clock. My uncle's cousin, who was there, told me about my father's name and my uncle's names and all that. So then I was kind of satisfied that he knows the family, so he'll be okay to go with. So I got into the refugee camp. And my uncle, he came because he was 30 miles away in a town called Kasur. So he came from there every day to look for us. My uncle didn't realize what I needed. That all I needed was hugged and loved and be assured that I'm safe now. Then, when I was 12 years old, then my life changed. I met my friend. With him, I found that I belonged to somebody. And I was not alone anymore. What my friend taught me, I forgave to the even people who killed my family. My own way of thinking is that just love everyone, hate no one. That's where I look at it.
That was the voice of one of the survivors of the 1947 partition of India and Pakistan. Today, August 15th, marks the anniversary of India's independence from Britain and the partitioning of the subcontinent. About 10 million people were forced to migrate, and an estimated 1 million people died from the rioting and fighting. You can find more stories of survivors of the partition on the Partition Archives website. That's 1947partitionarchive.org. And on Apex Express today, we're continuing to look at the shadow of independence as India celebrates its independence today, and Pakistan celebrated its independence yesterday. Kashmir shines the light on occupation. We're joined on the line by Mohammed Janad. He's a Kashmiri anthropologist living in New York. Janad, welcome to Apex Express.
Hi, thank you, Tara.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tell us about the significance of August 15th, Indian independence in Indian-occupied or Indian-administered Kashmir.
Well, as India celebrated its Independence Day, Kashmir was under total curfew and all the communications were snapped. Internet was banned and, you know, people could not communicate with each other and they were restricted to their homes. And this is something that I have, you know, as far as I can remember, this has been going on for many decades now. And this sums up the story of Kashmir's relationship with August 15. In 1947, Kashmiris were fighting for their political rights. They demanded that they be given citizenship rights from their ruler, who was a prince and ruled Kashmir. Although they expressed, you know, fraternal support to all the decolonization movement that was going on in the rest of the subcontinent, but in 1947, they expected that with the departure of the British colonizers, Kashmir will be free. But as it turned out, the partition and the, you know, freedom of both India and Pakistan turned out to be a nightmare for Kashmiris because it resulted in the two new states occupying portions of Kashmir after a short conflict. And the situation on the ground continues to remain so. The Indian held part of Kashmir has now more than 500,000 soldiers occupying every nook and corner of Kashmir, while the Pakistani held Kashmir also is heavily militarized. And for the last 64, 65 years now, there has been a movement going on which intensified in 1990 for the independence of Kashmir. So while August 15 is celebrated as a day of independence in India and August 14 in Pakistan, for Kashmiris, they observe it as a day of protest.
And Janad, you were talking earlier about in Indian-administered Kashmir, which is the most densely militarized land on earth, that today, it was under curfew. Internet was suspended. People are in their house. What does it look like when you're under curfew? What does the streets look like? Can you go out? What happens if someone's on the street? Can you just describe it for our listeners?
Well, curfew means that you can absolutely not venture out on the street, be it the shops, stores, and everything is forced to shut down. They impose martial law, according to which, you know, people can be shot at sight if they are seen outside or arrested minimally. And since Kashmir is, you know, under what is called Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which means that if, you know, Indian security forces shoot anybody or, you know, harass anybody, they cannot be held accountable in any for kind of civil courts, which gives virtual a real impunity to Indian security forces to act as they wish, and curfews become you know, special instances where Indian armed forces are given complete free hand to act against Kashmiris.
And how often do curfews tend to be enforced in Kashmir?
Often, you know, on August 15 or January 26, which India celebrates as Republic Day, and then there are other, you know, major occasions where and the authorities impose curfews. But whenever the Indian authorities sense that protests are about to take place, they impose curfews. And from 2008 to end of 2010, there were several weeks on end when curfews were imposed, during which time, you know, people had very limited access to food. Many people complained that they could not even get medicine for the sick or baby food for their children. So it depends on, you know, how the principle acts freedom in the Indian authorities in both countries.
You're cutting out a little bit, but let's see if we can get the connection a little bit better. Can you tell us a little bit about, you were talking about the internet getting cut. Does that, I mean, is it often that telecommunications and internet just get cut for the Kashmiris? And can you talk a little bit about the overall censorship of social media that Kashmir falls under?
Well, over the past 2 weeks, internet and telecommunications have been snapped twice now. There was violence which erupted in a district called Kishtwar in Jammu and Kashmir. It's a mountainous district, a hilly district where some government, government has given arms to one community of people who were involved in, provoking criminal violence in the region. And somehow the government decided to snap internet connections in Kashmir, under the pretext that the violence would spread. And then they did the same thing, on August 15th, during the pretext that the militants might use internet to, obstruct or launch attack on, celebrating an independence celebration. All of these pretexts are very flimsy, because if something similar happens in mainland India, internet or telecommunications would never be snapped.
And Janath, how widespread is the call for independence in Kashmir?
Well, one of the things that the pro-independence parties and organizations demand is a referendum to determine exactly, what people want. And the Indian government has decided not to grant Kashmiris the right to determine their own future. And this means that they are not going to hold a plebiscite, which was mandated by the United Nations Security Council resolutions. There are several of them, which exist, and even by India's own leaders, like Jawaharlal Nehru, who was the first Prime Minister of India. But over the last 25 years now, since the popular armed rebellion began, the support for independence has only grown, and in 2008, almost more than 500,000 people assembled in Srinagar to demand this, which was an unprecedented level of public expression of support for independence.
And when you're talking about 500,000 people in Srinagar, Srinagar being the capital of Kashmir, the entire population of Jammu and Kashmir is about, 7 million people?
I think that the Kashmir Valley would be around 6 million people.
6 million. So it's a huge portion of the population to have 500,000 out and marching. And Janath, what would freedom for Kashmir mean for you as a Kashmiri?
Well, for me, freedom would first of all mean the right to determine our own future, and the people of Kashmir should be given a democratic right to decide if they want to become free, they want to join Pakistan, or do they want to remain and become part of India. And this will solve the major political impasse in the region. But for me, the idea of independence and freedom also means to live a life of dignity and not to be harassed by armed soldiers on the street, not to be treated as lesser human, because laws like Armed Forces Special Powers Act do precisely that. They are created for people who are not given the right to a dignified life. Otherwise, there's no justification for such a law. The Indian government itself says that right now there are less than a couple of hundred armed militants in Kashmir, but they continue to, you know, deploy more than 500,000 Indian soldiers there. And these soldiers are there not fighting the armed militancy, but they are actually actively repressing the Kashmiri population. And freedom would be getting rid of this inhuman condition.
And Janad, in our last minute or so, if people are interested in learning more about the call by Kashmiris for independence and what's happening in the most densely militarized land on earth, where can people get more information?
Well, first of all, there are several Kashmiri newspapers which are in English. You know, one is Kashmir Reader, there's Rising Kashmir and Greater Kashmir. They publish news stories about Kashmir all the time. There are active Facebook, you know, groups like Kashmir Solidarity Network, where, you know, Kashmiri activists and scholars post news about Kashmir and their opinion. But there are also, you know, several scholarly sources. New books have come out. There is a new book by, Fahad Shah, an anthology called Of Occupation and Resistance, Writings from Kashmir. And there is a book which Arunmati Roy and Tariq Ali and others edited. It's called Kashmir, A Case for Freedom. And then there is Sanjay Kak's anthology, Until My Freedom Has Come. Now, all of these, Bashar Yu's book, The Food Night, is there, and Mirza Wahid's excellent novel, Collaborator, is available. All of these textual resources exist, and people who are interested in knowing more about Kashmir should actually look at them.
Well, Janad, thank you so much for joining us on India's Independence Day and shedding a light on the occupation in Kashmir.
Thank you, Tara.
You are tuned into Apex Express, and I have our calendar of events for you, for all of our South Bay folks. The Center of Asian American Media is proud to present CamFest in San Jose from August 16th to 18th at Camera 3. There will be a 3-day session of films, premieres, social events, and special programs spotlighting the creativity and vitality of Asian Americans in San Jose and Silicon Valley. You can get tickets at caamedia.org/CamFestSJ for San Jose. That's August 16th through 18th, starting Friday at 6:30 p.m. in San Jose. We also have the Summit of Awesomeness with Grand Hallway Go Nakamura and Scrabble at Cafe du Nord on August 20th. That's music. I had to like Google it. They didn't even tell me on the announcement. I was like, what is this? It's Tuesday, August 20th at 8 p.m. The Summit of Awesomeness. Looks like some great bands. That's Cafe du Nord in San Francisco on Market Street. And we also have CounterPulse Presents the Performing Diaspora Weekend 2. More info on CounterPulse's website. You can get archives, podcasts, and more at our website, which is apexexpress.org. Our intro and outro music is by Asian Crisis, thanks to Jill Montgomery on the boards. Next up is The Bonnie Simmons Show.